When there's an active problem in the body on a visceral level, we believe that that is going to be reflected in some way on the surface, on the way level that you can put your fingers on. And there's actually a science behind this, but large intestine 11 is a very classic area of the body that has that beautifully connected reflection of the lung problem, the lung heat.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Cheological, the podcast that curates East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation. I have a patient with insomnia. It's the wake up at 3 a.m. kind of insomnia. It bothers her some in that she knows the importance of sleep, but she also loves it because that is when she allows herself to read some fiction that she won't allow herself to read during the day, or sometimes listen to music that she doesn't have time for in her busy life. It's a bit of a curious thing, and I don't think that she's alone in that there are experiences that nourish her heart, but we don't make the time in the day for them. And then we are left with a kind of empty hunger and unspoken despair. So she's on friendly terms with her insomnia, because in the middle of the night, she'll allow that which during the day is considered too unproductive. I get where she's coming from. I too fill my days with what's productive, and there's a satisfaction in feeling that I've wrung an extra measure out of the day. But then, in the middle of the night, the empty heat of striving and not giving my spirit something curious or delightful to dream over leaves my sleep feeling thin and less than satisfying. I like the idea of stealing some time for delight. That feels a bit radical, like a dissident, like stealing fire from the gods. And it reminds me that while the body needs rest, so too does the spirit. I have another patient. When he wakes, he'll say some short prayers of appreciation for the people in his life. It's a worthwhile practice to recognize, remember, and appreciate those you care about. And this practice gives the mind something soothing to do in the middle of the dark. He blesses rather than frets. I'm appreciative of how both of these people have made friends with waking at night in a way that adds something to their life. And I'm reminded, too, how people will often enough find a solution to a problem that is not something the experts would recommend, but it fits the quirk of who they are, and so it works. It's not for everybody, but it is for them. And after all, isn't that what East Asian medicine is about? Finding a solution that's right for the particular person in front of you in this particular moment. Acupuncture is a curious medicine, and the longer I practice, the more curious it becomes. I think that is because the way we pay attention has a lot to do with the ways in which we work, and it's helpful to be inquisitive. Our guests today, a father and son team, Joe and Sam Audette. Joe found his way into an acupuncturist office after wrestling a Volkswagen as a young man, and Sam, one day, he noticed his dad was actually doing some pretty cool stuff. Joe has a background in conventional medicine, but his interest in acupuncture has taken him into German medicine and the work of Kiko Matsumoto. I especially appreciate in this conversation beginning to get a handle on some of Kiko's work. We'll get into all of this and plenty more in a moment. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. These conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Worried that an EMR is too complex for you? Jane has friendly and knowledgeable support. Mayway Herbs is celebrating the 55th year of their family business. You're invited to make use of their vast library of resources. Are you concerned about the health of Mother Earth? AccuFast Needles is doing something about that. You can too. And later in the show, Ancestral Sturman offers up a sinew treatment, and the folks at Blue Poppy have something special to share as well. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Geological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast.
Hi folks, I'm Yvonne Lau, president of Mayway Herbs. Our family business turns 55 this year, and we wouldn't have gotten this far without the love and support of our community. We're truly grateful and promise you that we'll continue to work hard to support you and your practice. Please visit Mayway.com to find the perfect Pumsar brand formula or formulate your own in our dispensary. Our site also has lots of articles, videos, and herbal recipes for you to explore. And tune into our podcast, Chinese Medicine Matters, for insightful discussions on all things TCM. Learn about treatment strategies and powerful herbal remedies. As we welcome the month of May, our focus is on women's health. Our newsletter articles and podcast episodes this month will highlight different aspects and unique challenges women face. So subscribe or tune in. And if you're a practitioner, get a discount on our women's health formulas this month. Just visit Mayway.com. This season and every season, trust Mayway Herbs for your health and wellness needs. And thank you for supporting Real Chinese Medicine.
I love how technology can help to automate my office, and I want to share with you my favorite tool for doing so, Jane. Jane is a clinic management software in EMR with a human touch. Whether you're switching your software or going paperless for the first time, the Jane team knows that the onboarding process can feel a little overwhelming. That's why with Jane, you don't just get software, you get a whole team. Included in every Jane subscription is their award-winning customer support available by phone, email, and chat whenever you need it, even Saturdays. You can also book a free account setup consultation to review your account and ensure you feel confident about going live. If you're interested in making the switch to Jane, head to jane.app/switch to book a one-on-one demo with a member of their support team. And be sure to mention the code CHEOLOGICAL at the time of sign up for a one-month grace period on your new Jane account. I don't know about you, but sometimes I take a step back and marvel at my acupuncture needles. I mean, they're the world's simplest medical tool. A sharpened wire and a handle. That's it. And with this simple tool, hundreds of health conditions can be resolved. I love it. What I didn't love was the amount of packaging waste I generated at the end of the day. But that has now changed too. Ever since I switched to AccuFast Earth-Friendly Needles, I reduced my packaging waste by 90%. Not only are they a great needle, but the folks at AccuFast plant a tree for every two boxes of needles I use in the clinic. By switching to AccuFast Needles, you'll be helping patients, planting trees, and joining a community of practitioners changing the world. Like our simple needle, being a part of the solution, it's simple too. Visit AccuFastNeedles.com/geological to learn how. Sam and Joe Odette, welcome to Geological.
Great to be here, Michael.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's wonderful to be here.
I'm delighted to have you guys. So you guys are a father-son team. And a father-son team in that you both do acupuncture. You're American, like regular American guys. Joe, you're an MD as well. Yep. Sam, I think you're still a student, aren't you? Are you still a student or have you graduated?
I'm in that limbo between graduations and boards.
Oh boy, how exciting. Yeah. So, you know, acupuncture has been in our country long enough that members of the dominant culture, so to speak. Ooh, can I say that word?
I think that's safe. That sounds good to me.
Is it safe? All right, we might get in trouble, but you know what I mean? Mainstream culture, that's the word.
Yeah, okay.
Right? It's been in mainstream culture long enough that we're getting like regular old American guys. We got generations of acupuncturists now. That's really cool. That tells you something about, you know, what's happening with our tradition. So I want to talk to you guys about that. And Joe, you're also an MD and you teach acupuncture. You help MDs learn about it. We're going to talk about that. Why don't we just start real briefly?
Give us a quick introduction to who you are and a little bit about your background. Joe, we'll start with you. Like, you know, older guys first, because we're okay. Chinese medicine practitioners. We respect the old guys.
Yes, exactly. Well, I'm a physician, but I started my experience with acupuncture prior to becoming a physician. And it was one of those situations where I was in my early mid-20s and had no health insurance and had an old VW that I was trying to change the tire on. It was all rusted out and herniated a disc. Looking back now as a physician, I know I herniated a disc. But at that time, I just had suddenly severe pain shooting down my leg and didn't know what to do. And so some of the people that I was working with at that time suggested I try acupuncture. And I was very open to that idea because my mother had a path where she herself had started seeking alternatives to some health issues she had, especially with stomach ulcers. And she was very much into this health writer named Adele Davis when I was growing up. Yeah, really old style health.
Oh my goodness. That's old school. Yeah. Okay. So you're from a family of weirdos.
Yeah. Weird stuff, eating, you know, taking vitamins and drinking all these weird drinks. That anyway, so the idea of acupuncture was very attractive to me. And I went to this by chance, this Chinese gentleman, and he put a bunch of points in, but eventually put a point in the back of my knee, which I now know was bladder 40. At that time, I had no idea what it was. Had this almost electric-like shock feeling to it. And then suddenly, I just felt the pain just drain out of my back into my leg, and it was gone. And so one of these aha experiences for me that led me to think that at some point, I want to learn how to do this. I want this to be a part of my life. And it just was a kind of very convoluted path that eventually led me to medicine. But along that way, I kept thinking, once I get into medicine, I want to learn this, which was quite a challenge. Medicine at the time I was in school in the late 80s, early 90s was not at all open to acupuncture. And I had opportunities.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Harvard Medical School, so I don't think it would have been any different anywhere, but anywhere else. They did have David Eisenberg floating around and Ted Kapchuk floating around in the background, but we got no exposure to them as medical students. It was all about drugs, very little even about anatomy. They were starting to think, oh, we don't need to know anatomy. You just need to know physiology and all there is to know about drugs, basically. So it was not something that I had a great affinity for, and I kept trying to not get completely brainwashed while I was in medical school, which is part of what happens. You have to do a deep dive to learn anything, and that's something that we tell our physicians that we're training now in acupuncture. You have to kind of suspend judgment to learn something in a deep way. And for me, I had a lot of feelings that a lot of what I was learning in medical school was not really what was good for human health. But I kept going through, and then eventually as a resident in New York at Columbia Presbyterian, we invited the head of an acupuncture school named Mark Seam. I don't know if you, through the years, have heard Mark Seam. He's
talk about anatomy. So you invite the guy who was really into anatomy.
Yes, he was very into anatomy, very into this whole thing that I also got into, which was using an acupuncture needle to do trigger point work on muscles and so on. And I again while he was lecturing, I was very quick to volunteer because he wanted to demonstrate on somebody, and had my first experience of a deep needling technique that he used for this trigger point needling. And so I decided to start going to the school he had, which was called the Tri-State Traditional School of Chinese Medicine in New York. But of course, they had to teach that for the boards. But Mark Seam was very into French energetics and all this other stuff related to trigger points. And then it was there that I met Kiko Matsumoto. She would come down every other weekend from Boston and do grand rounds and then stay the whole weekend to supervise the clinics. And so I also got extremely impressed by her approach and her approach to palpation to help diagnose and find the path to help patients be treated. So all of that had this huge effect on me. And it's really been the rest of my clinical career trying to integrate those two different styles. And maybe we can talk about that as the conversation goes on. But that was what brought me back to my original goal of going into medicine. And that was to find a way to integrate acupuncture into my practice.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? Sometimes we'll have an experience like the one you had, right? I got this broken down Volkswagen and it's breaking me down because, you know, I just wrenched my back. Then you have an experience, it changes you. It like literally puts you on a different path. You may not notice it at the moment, but like pivotal moment. Now, you're on a whole new trajectory. And then it takes like years or decades to wind yourself around to where you're headed. It's so surprising to me how sometimes you can get a glimpse. It's like you get a glimpse of the promised land, you get a glimpse of the future. And then it's gone. It's not that it's gone, but it's just like you can't see it now. You could see it now. Now you can't, but it's like a beacon. It kind of draws you.
Yeah, it set you on a different path. And then as long as you just keep your faith that there's going to be a way to realize some of those initial insights.
Yeah, and so this is in the 80s that you wrenched your back?
Yeah, the 80s, mid-80s, yeah.
Mid-80s.
1984 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Acupuncture was just barely beginning to find its way into the mainstream at that point. Just barely.
Right. And at those times, people still use those needles that they would sharpen. And it was, you know, there was the modern stainless steel disposable needles were, I guess, available, but a lot of the Chinese practitioners were still using.
Oh yeah. No, they were
acupuncture kits. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I talked to guys that made their own needles back.
Yeah.
Back in the old days. I talked to guys that use guitar wires, you know, guitar strings to make needles.
Wow.
Crazy. Yeah. I mean, that's our heritage. Well, okay, Joe, we're gonna come back to more of this in just a moment. Sam, what the heck is it like growing up with an acupuncturist dad?
Yeah, well, I grew up thinking that it was normal and that everyone knew what acupuncture was. and then I slowly started to realize that that was not the norm. My dad never really, was saying, "Oh, you got to go into medicine, you got to go into acupuncture." You know, it was just always a part of our lifestyle. And I saw how much it enriched his life to be studying Chinese medicine. He kind of scared me away from going into become a physician a little bit, just talking about the aches and pains of what that is like to deal with in the modern clinical setting. But we grew up going to martial arts together. We had this teacher, Master Liang, who, well, I believe, was he the one who initially treated you?
Did the acupuncture. So what he said after he did the acupuncture, he said, "You're weak. You have to study martial. You have to study with me. Get strong. Do Tai Chi." You know. So.
He was not wrong, was he?
Yeah, he wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong.
Yeah. So we grew up with this wonderful teacher, Master Liang, who my dad studied with for 30 years, and I would take classes with him and his wife as well, who was Master Han Lin, a Tai Chi teacher. And so that was always kind of a part of our life, and that culture. They were both from Taiwan. His story is really interesting. Maybe my dad can say more about him, but yeah. And then I kind of fell into acupuncture through, I started to help my dad make some videos, and I discovered what he'd been holding out on me with all this interesting, palpation stuff. And yeah, I was hooked. Yeah.
So helping him make videos, how old are you when you start doing this? And how is it that you missed out on this essential thing that your dad was doing?
No, I always had it in the back of my head, but I guess when I went to undergrad and it wasn't one of the majors you could select, acupuncture. So it just kind of wasn't in my radar necessarily at that time, but I always kind of had it in my head. And then, after I finished undergrad, I started to help my dad making some videos for his acupuncture course, and kind of got more into that. We made you know, 50 plus videos. We were kind of redoing his whole course, the video material. And so I got an insight into what he was doing and just kind of fell in love with it. But it was, I think the real deciding point was when I, you know, went to his course and I got to see the colleagues that he's working with, see all these people who, you know, were practicing acupuncture and were also physicians, which was really interesting. But see how it, you could see how acupuncture really enriched their lives and how it gave them, you know, this depth was really attractive. And so that's kind of what sold me into the field.
That's interesting.
And Sam, you also had the opportunity to interview, we did a series of interviews of some of the acupuncturists that we would have come teach from Europe, for example, like Michael Hammes and Dominique Ehrnisch. The German physician acupuncture world has gone back probably 100 years. So it's richer and older than what we're seeing in the United States. And we bring these teachers from Germany sometimes, and Sam would have the opportunity to interview them and do videos of their life story, I think. Is that right, Sam? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. And, also Ana Nieves from Mexico. So I kind of got to see different acupuncturists. I mean, your course has people from different countries, which is amazing. So you get to see how it, you know, we have this wonderful teacher, Marcia Yamamura from Brazil, and Ilaria Merlot from Italy. So it's pretty amazing to see how different folks in different countries are using acupuncture. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We don't really hear that much about what's going on abroad here in the States. We really don't. Not so much at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Yeah. Other than maybe China, but we don't understand the extent to which it's really a worldwide phenomenon.
It's a worldwide phenomenon. How would you characterize, you're saying that it goes back 100 years in Germany, how would you characterize the acupuncture with these German physicians that you're working with? How's that similar or different than the average acupuncture that you see here in the States?
Yes, I think it's much more grounded in TCM than certainly what we're teaching, because we have Kiko as our sensei and our guiding master. So, but on the other hand, they innovated, and there are certain German physicians. There's this one beautiful gentleman named Jochen Gledisch, who is just passed away, I think he was 97, but he had developed this whole other approach to acupuncture. So still with some backing and TCM, but using the needle as an instrument to determine point that was hypersensitive, that he would call the very point, and would tell him that point wants a needle. And he had this whole technique of examining the body in this very gentle way with an acupuncture needle to determine these extra special sensitive points that needed treatment, and had a whole theory and approach to that. So I think, although grounded TCM, because they also, on the other hand, were not maybe as bound by the idea of the traditions and cultural aspects that may prevent innovation in China, possibly, although I think there's a lot of innovation there too. There were a lot of paths that were quite different than TCM. And so that, I think, is interesting, because I think it's clear that acupuncture is evolving. It's not a monolithic entity that is really just Chinese anymore. And that has actually been true anyway for hundreds of years, with different approaches that have really been modified from the original Chinese approach in Japan and Korea and in Vietnam, but certainly in Europe that tradition continues in terms of the evolution of acupuncture. I would say that also, because of the demands of teaching other physicians, that there's always this very strong emphasis in trying to the extent that you can, ground any teaching in the science that's available, because of how physician continuing medical education hours go. If you don't do that, you actually can't get credit. And so that, I think, makes all the physicians that do acupuncture and teach acupuncture hyper aware of where is the science right now, where can we pull little bits of science in to support this clinical experience that we have so that it's not just expert opinion. And that's, I think, possibly a little bit different than Sam could comment on this, and that is true in the licensed acupuncture world. I'm not sure, but.
Sam, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to meet the German acupuncturists. I don't know to what extent they have non-physician acupuncturists in Germany. I know some countries, you know, in Europe are less, or, you know, they have, it's more of a physician practice, and then there are other countries where they may have separate licensure. But, you know, one thing that really sticks out to me is, you know, how it's integrated into medical hospitals, even in Germany, like Dominique Ernich. He's, I think, the chairman of German Acupuncture Association. He was able to get now pericardium 6 is part of their standard of care in pre-surgery to prevent vomiting and things like that, and nausea, which I thought was fascinating. We don't see that yet in hospitals in the U.S., but in terms of the licensed acupuncture world, I mean, and like taking my dad's course and then taking, going through acupuncture school in California. I mean, there's definitely a lot of emphasis on the science in acupuncture school. We definitely have to write a lot of papers and research and all that, but there's not necessarily, I think in the physician world, to varying degrees, there's, you know, some physicians will only want to follow where the science is, and then others are willing to go where their experience takes them. And maybe there isn't that same pressure in the licensed acupuncture world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as a physician as well, you know, an MD, like you were saying, Joe, there are certain things you have to do, certain requirements that you have to be able to hit in terms of continuing education, keeping your license. No small thing. You know, I'm struck too here. I just want to step back for just a second, looking at this German tradition. It's so great hearing you guys talk about, and even more, having access to folks like this. I know that when I was in acupuncture school, I was introduced to a great book on rheumatology from the French acupuncturists. It was put out by, in fact, it just came out from Eastland Press when I was still in school, and had this idea of barrier points, all these different ways of working, all these energetics and ways of thinking about the great channels. And it was a little bit mind-blowing. And it's all coming from these physicians, because I think in France, you have to be a physician. And so, and of course, they've had acupuncture there much longer because of their experience in Indochina. What's fascinating to me is much of our Chinese medicine comes really from TCM. Those are the main books that were translated and used here in the States. But if there's 100-year or more tradition in Asia, those original people that were using acupuncture back then, that is pre-TCM. That's like Republican-era medicine. And that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Absolutely, right. Yeah, I think our impression is based on a variety of things, including, I don't know if you've heard of a woman named Bridie Andrews, but she's a historian, medical historian, but has a special interest in acupuncture and Asian medicines, including Japan, Korea, and China. But she really looks at TCM as the greatest export that China has ever developed. And it really isn't necessarily at all like the original classical acupuncture in many ways, if you look at how it evolved in China in the 20th century. But it is the dominant force in the world still, if we look at the interactions that we have with other physicians, and for good reason. I think it has enough roots in the classics to be a good basis for then moving further along, if possible, into other realms if you're able to, and not just get stuck with the TCM approach. but I think it is a good basis to understand the basic theory.
I would agree with you. Plus, it gives us the vocabulary and a perspective. I've had the good fortune to spend a little time in Taiwan, a little time on the mainland, and I found that with my basic Chinese medicine education from the state, I could sit down with doctors there. I could grasp what they were talking about. They may have had a very different way of thinking, but the fundamentals, we all share the fundamentals. You know, and the cool thing is like, oh, that kind of rhymes with something I've heard about or know, or maybe it's really different than something I know, but I can root it down into something fundamental.
Exactly, yes.
So, you know, I know TCM gets a lot of bad press. He says, oh, TCM, communist export, terrible thing, right? Take everything out of it. Well, you know, any system, you're going to put some things in and take some out. But as a foundation, it's a solid foundation.
Right. And that's what, when we're teaching this predominantly Kiko style on the clinical side, we try to the extent that we can to give them a good foundation in TCM, because then they won't, if they just learn a Kiko style, as you may have some sense of already from your previous experience with Kiko, but you don't really have a basis of communicating as much as we think it is important for them to do with their colleagues who will have had that TCM background. So we really want to make sure that they have that language.
Yeah.
Because it is so important for that common means of communication with colleagues across the spectrum.
Right. It's like the Putonghua. It's the common language. TCM is a common language. Well, this is something I wanted to ask you about too, Joe. Again, you're an MD, you're an acupuncturist, spent a lot of time with Kiko. And I'm thinking to myself, I was thinking this morning before we were sitting down for the conversation, like, this is going to be great. I get to talk to a guy who's explaining Kiko to MD-type physicians. I've had a little experience with Kiko, just a small amount, and I'm thinking I could use someone to explain Kiko to me, and I'm an acupuncturist. I mean, it's a whole different way of thinking and working, you know, and Kiko herself is like a force of nature.
And she keeps evolving, and what we found, we have the old Kiko style that we teach to try to get everyone on a common page, because now Kiko is almost never using any of the things that we teach because she keeps finding something new, getting interested in some other approach. And then when you watch her work, she'll predominantly use these new ideas and new points that have very little relationship to what we're teaching. But the common basis of how it all still ties together is in that palpation approach of the hara, of the abdomen. And then checking, or what we call point verification, making sure that if you think this needle location is going to work or these points are going to work, make sure that you see something change on the body. Make sure that you don't rely on theory, that you rely on the patient's body to ground you and make sure that what you're doing is working. And what we found, well, what I found when I was first learning, especially having just gone through medical school, had to do that deep dive into that approach of thinking about the human body. And then I started on nights and weekends studying in Mark Seam's school and trying to really get these Chinese theories to be workable, to be usable in a way that I could choose points. I felt very uncertain, very hesitant, very, very nervous that I wasn't going to be able to do it. And then I saw Kiko and I said, hey, that I can approach because I know anatomy. I know how I can even translate what she's saying in terms of where she's palpating into certain anatomical concepts and use those reflection zones to give me confidence. And then, of course, that then gives your patient confidence that, yes, this point really is working because see, now I'm jamming my finger into your abdomen and it no longer hurts. And so that was something that I needed early in my career because of with any new medical knowledge, when you're first learning it, you even if you're extremely experienced in your field prior to that, but suddenly you branch into something new, you're going to have this lack of confidence. And that, to me, was especially true with trying to apply TCM theory to decide what points to use on a patient's body. And so Kigo gave me a path to start to try to ultimately understand Chinese theory, but then also to help dive in to start treating patients without feeling so uncertain.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Real-time feedback.
Yes. Very, very important. It really can apply to TCM as well if people wanted to. It doesn't have to be a...
Hello, everyone. Anne Cecil Sturman here. A working knowledge of the 8 extraordinary channels from the unbroken oral tradition of acupuncture is valuable beyond words. The power of these channels is tremendous if the practitioner has well-integrated diagnostic, theoretical, and practical skill. You'll be familiar with Dumai, the governor channel or the sea of yang, the primal reservoir of yang, which ultimately finances all movement and growth. But this channel also governs the ability to self-determine. The psycho-emotional presentation of your patients can be matched to a classical activation of this channel, clearing impedance in the free flow of yang qi to body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to share with you the marvelous potency of the Du channel in a full-length live treatment video from the seminar I taught last year in Melbourne, Australia. It's at annececilsturman.com/sinews2024. Click on the Jump to Free Teaching button or see the link on my Instagram page at annececilsturman. Thanks, Michael. Back to you.
So tell me more about that. Tell me more how this can apply to TCM, because, I mean, TCM is kind of beautiful in a way. It's, you know, it's very poetic, and we have these lovely ideas, and the theories are, you know, we can get kind of tied into the theories because they're pretty. But theory is theory, isn't it? Often theory is wrong, right? Or maybe you're just not applying it right, or maybe the theory is right, you're just applying it wrong. There's that. So having that capacity to go and check your work as you go, like part theory, part practical, I think that would help a lot of people. There's a good reason, I think, why if you're just working in theory, you don't feel confident. It's because you don't know, and you got to wait a week to find out if it helped or not. And what if they don't come back because it helped so good they don't even need you, or it didn't help at all? I mean, you just don't know. It's terrible. You need to have the feedback.
Right, right. You don't even get that feedback. That's true. That's always a possible outcome if they don't come back because they felt great.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. I've met people at the grocery store like, hey, I haven't seen you in 5 years. Thanks for getting rid of the back pain. It's like, God, I...
Yeah, I know. I've had that experience too. I had this one patient recently I saw after, I think it was about 15 years. She goes, yeah, you did this acupuncture treatment on me 15 years ago. And I was cured. I thought she didn't like it. You know, because she never came back, and it was like, no, and now I'm coming back, I have a new problem.
That's right, yeah. So how can people who are using TCM start to apply this principle of checking their work?
Yeah, and we get some experience, because when I go to Germany, we bring some of these German doctors here, but then I'll go to Munich and teach there, and they'll often have a clinic where we're treating very, very chronic patients, and you'll have the German students, and I can't give them I do give them a little bit of an introduction into Kigo style, but I can't suddenly say, well, discard all the points that you think are useful and just use the points I think are useful. So I've had the experience of saying, well, you love liver 3. With this Kigo style, we love liver 4. No one uses liver 4 except us, but it's, you know, the metal on the wood meridian, the wood, you know, so it has this controlling effect on blood stagnation. So we always use liver 4, but very much what I've seen is the natural tendency in TCM would be to use liver 3. So I'll say, okay, let's try. You go liver 3, and I'm going to check the abdomen and see if this region that we think reflects blood stagnation clears. And often it will. So then it also made me realize there's more than one way that you can use a TCM approach and get these same effects. But if you could just get them to find something that they could correlate. And I think the problem is some of the things that they examine, like the tongue, the pulse can change for sure. And so that maybe should be an emphasis more with the TCM practitioner. But I think learning a little of the basics of the abdominal exam could give another clue to a TCM practitioner that their treatment is changing the body, that there's an effect going. And I think there's ways of simplifying that abdominal diagnosis into using the five element theory, where you just keep it simple, almost like it was first discussed in the Nanjing, where, you know, wood is just to the left of the umbilicus and metal is just to the right of the umbilicus. You know, just keep these certain regions in your mind and use those as some type of feedback system could be helpful to a TCM practitioner.
Uh-huh. Can you give us a few other pointers for those that are, you know, sort of by the book, so to speak, or don't have so much experience with Kiko? We'll get more into Kiko in a moment. But and by the way, before we do this, I just want to comment, hearing that what Kiko does now is not what Kiko did 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Is so wonderful to hear, because I don't know any of us that are doing what we did 10 years ago. And, you know, the true sign of someone who's in it and learning from it and doing it is that their work will change. It will be different. And if it's not different, then I'm scratching my head.
Yeah, so we've come up with a way of also grounding some of Kiko's early insights into the abdomen. And a lot of her work was also informed by other great Japanese masters, but Kiko is our sensei. So I'll focus on her. But if you also look anatomically, so in the, just to the left of the abdomen at the stomach 26, 27 area is considered the wood region, or what Kiko calls oketsu, which is basically a Japanese word for blood stagnation. And then what we do is try to relate that. Well, why? The Chinese knew that the liver was on the right side under the ribs. Why in the world would this left stomach 26, 27 area reflect this wood-like function of blood stagnation? And the reason that we teach our students is because underneath that is the portal vein. So the portal vein that brings the nutrients, but also the toxins, if there's a lot of stagnation, because oketsu in Japan actually means dirty blood. So also if someone's very toxic, so that portal vein is bringing the nutrients, possibly toxins, up to the liver to metabolize. But in that left stomach 26, 27 area, that's where you can palpate that portal vein area. And then the right stomach 26, 27 area, which reflects the metal function or lung, let's say, is right over the ileocecal valve and also over the appendix. So suddenly that makes sense. So, okay, the appendix, the greatest immune organ in the body that, of course, now we discard so readily, but probably has more value than we realize. And also that ileocecal valve, where the small intestine, sterile, large intestine, full of bacteria and all kinds of other things, you know, occurs. And having that valve be functional, be, you know, effective, so that you don't get the, you know, the movement of bacteria up into the small intestines is so important. And again, reflects this big concept in Chinese medicine that we in the West could think of as the immune system, but which they think of as this complex Chinese organ, the lung.
And associated with Wei Qi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wei Qi and a lot of the qi's in our body. Yeah. So it's a really nice way of starting to make sense of those two basic points. And then, of course, below the umbilicus is the kidney function. But Kiko thinks of it right as the root of the umbilicus. So you're trying to dig your fingers right just inferior to the umbilicus, trying to do a deep dive to that root. And so that's the water function. So that makes sense. On some level, it's like the source of, you know, it's the first, you know, as we evolve in the embryo, that is the source of all our energy, that qi, that comes from the kidney. So that kind of makes sense. And then above the umbilicus, and that as you move to the chest is the fire or the heart. And that sort of can satisfy some physicians when they're first learning that would be the fire function. So we try to get people to think of the abdomen as this basically this clock. The one that's the hardest is earth, because earth is this center of that is in the ancient text is considered this sort of big circle around the umbilicus. It's not the root of the umbilicus, but it's this big circle. And it's a little bit more difficult to palpate out the earth function. And that sometimes you do with temperature, like a cold abdomen. There are other more subtle techniques. So the earth function is the most subtle part of the abdominal diagnosis that is probably takes some time, I would say. And you could maybe use other inputs from the TCM, from the pulse, from the tongue that could help you determine that the earth is in need of help.
So really what I hear you saying, Joe, is we can take our five phase map, put it right on the belly.
Yep.
I love this. And I actually love the idea that earth is a little hard to grasp, because I tend to think of earth as in the middle. Everything goes through earth. Everything goes through earth. And so earth is a little bit diffuse that way. It's very connective. I mean, it's a thing of its own, but it's also the thing that connects everything.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's that. But regardless, being able to look at the abdomen, fire above, water below. We got the wood over on the left and the metal on the right. And you know, just being able to take that, go in, put my hand on an abdomen and just go, what's here? Is there anything here? Can I notice anything? Because look, especially in the beginning, I'm kind of dull wood, I know for myself. And I'll put my hands on, it's like, yeah, I don't get nothing. I got nothing here. But the trick is to keep putting your hands on. At a certain point, sometimes it's like, oh, wait a minute, what's this? Okay, now I can go investigate. Oh, that's a blood stagnation thing. Right. All right. I'm gonna go try that thing Joe told me about, liver four.
Liver four. The metal on wood point. Very, very good for.
Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it? I mean, that would totally.
Yeah, it does. And that's I think the brilliance is that the Kiko style brings you to these points that you may never use otherwise if you hadn't thought about something a little beyond the TCM approach. I know Sam is sometimes has a hard time because in his clinic, you probably want to use Kiko style, but you still have to use the TCM approach.
Well, no. Going back to what you were saying before, I mean, it was, you know, I got to learn a little bit of Kiko style and take my dad's course and learn from him before going to TCM school and before going to acupuncture school. So that was an interesting kind of transition to then have to kind of put all that aside and learn a different approach. But I, you know, always kept the palpation aspect, you know, and in the clinic, we had a great clinic in Santa Monica at Emperor's College. And, you know, I learned a lot of different approaches. You know, every supervisor was doing something different. But I would always love to kind of go and check the abdomen and see maybe what was changing with the points that I was using in that particular style or, you know, and yeah, oftentimes, you know, the abdomen will start changing, you know, with a very different set of points, you know, with the liver three or whatever else, you know, so that was cool to kind of play around with a little bit and be forced to use different techniques, different approaches. Yeah. The Mu points are another really nice kind of introductory thing you can always check too, you know, in terms of seeing, and that kind of really I think translates well with a TCM view and seeing which Mu points are tender and
we make a lot of the Mu points as being reflective of the organ as they are, I guess, and that's another secondary way, especially for example spleen, liver 13 is a good point to go for. It's the spleen Mu point. If you can't find anything else on the abdomen, check that liver 13.
Now, on both sides or one side in particular?
Weirdly, for the spleen, it will reflect often on both sides. as opposed to the liver moot point, almost always in my experience, if it's interesting or active, it's just on the side of the liver, on the right side. But spleen, it seems to be diagnostic on both sides.
And the liver moo on the liver side, but if there's oketsu, if there's that dirty blood, also kind of a liver issue, but we're really looking at a blood stagnation aspect of liver, you're going to find that on the left.
Right. That's the weird thing, but if just remembering that, oh, the portal vein, and that connects the intestines to the liver, that helps to remind people that if they have some understanding of anatomy, why that may be. But it is odd, but it's very, very reliable. So it's something that what's interesting, when I was learning from Mark C., although he loved Kiko, because he never used it as much, probably, as for a variety of reasons, I'm not sure, he was always somewhat uncertain about whether it could be taught as a basis of a system. And so we were able to show him that eventually, some years later, when we would have Mark visit our physician course, that, yep, we've been now teaching it. It really does work. If you just stick with these basic principles, you can teach it to people who are really at the ultimate beginning of learning anything about acupuncture.
This goes back to something you said earlier in the conversation, that when you're in the process of learning something, like you with Western medicine, you got to take a deep dive. You got to drink the Kool-Aid. You got to believe it. You got to see what it is from its own perspective. Put yourself completely into it. And then later you can kind of come out, see what fits, see what doesn't, see what you want to use, see what, you know, maybe doesn't fit. And it sounds like by going deeply into the work with Kiko, which I mean, I've only been to one class. She came and did a class one weekend here in Missouri, maybe 10 years ago. And all I remember about that weekend was I had a headache at the end.
Yeah.
Because trying to keep up with Kiko, I couldn't do it. I mean, it was overwhelming. It was totally drinking out of a fire hose. And yet I know many people, they can really use it. I love, probably because of my own background, I love the idea of putting your hands on people to learn about what's going on with them. Because the body is reliable if you know how to talk to it. It takes time, but you can do it. So I love that aspect of what she was doing, but I could not grasp what was going on with the mental gymnastics. So it's wonderful talking to someone like you who's worked with it long enough that you can distill out, oh yeah, like oketsu, and go check this. I know it's more complex than that, but it's so helpful to have something that will give an entree where you can grab it. It's like, oh, I see, I got a footing. And once you got a footing, you can go on to the next thing.
Right, absolutely. And start getting that, learning how to get the fingers to have that sensitivity.
Yes.
That is always a challenge. But
so how do you do that? How do you build that sensitivity? And I'm going to direct that towards Sam, because he's kind of he's in the midst of learning. Well, you know, he had a tailwind, he had you. But Sam, how do you develop your sensitivity for palpation?
Well, you know, I feel like my dad is feeling butterflies and things in his fingers that I don't necessarily feel as much yet. But yeah, you know, what I really like hearing him talk about with both Kiko style, but also his trigger point approach, which I've kind of learned as well, is to have a listening hand. You know, you're having a hand that's just resting and feeling very gently on the tissue. And sometimes that, you know, allows you to feel more and to feel wells and things like that. But So I think with developing, you know, I think I've let the palpation aspect kind of take away from my pulse skills, because I've had always loved checking the palpatory, you know, correlates, and it kind of allows you to be a little lazier with pulse. So that's something I'm now trying to remedy, which, you know, even in the Kiko style, we do use pulse. And, you know, I know that my dad is very good at feeling the stomach chi in a pulse, which is another way to get the earth element. One reflex I really love checking that I think is pretty easy for people to begin with is kidney two. which is a fire point. Checking the fire points, that's one thing. If my friends, you know, who are in more of the TCM world or another style want to learn any kind of Japanese or Kiko, I always kind of bring that in because it's a very easy points to check. And the kidney two in particular, really, you know, you can start to feel changes there. It gets really hard. It gets tight. And often it's painful and you can kind of almost feel the pain there because it's very sensitive often. And that's a great point to play around with releasing using the water point or the metal point. You can use those together, which basically cool down the fire. And I feel like that's a really, I think that's kind of how I started to get my sensitivity up is I would just, you know, at dinner parties, I would feel people's fire points and try to convince them that acupuncture can work. No.
So now, is this all fire points, not just kidney two, but you could check any fire point if it's tight, striated, gummy, whatever.
Tender, yeah.
Tender. That would tell you that the fire is excessive? Is that the idea?
Yeah.
There's some kind of heat or inflammation, let's say, in the meridian and maybe in the organ. But it doesn't necessarily, I know, well, we still believe that kidney can never be in excess. So I know there's some debate because I was listening to this other podcast you had with this other practitioner, but it doesn't mean that you can't have heat or inflammation in the kidney meridian. And that's also could potentially affect the kidney organ. And that fire point is our reliable reflex to check that. And the exceptions are the earth elements. So although they sometimes can reflect a fire in the meridian, a heat in the meridian, but the interesting thing about the earth element is that the fire point is the tonification point.
Mm-hmm.
For that. So maybe those are a little bit less reliable than, say, all the other fire points that we'd like to check. Yeah.
Would you say that the earth point on the earth channel might be more indicative of a problem?
I would say that, yeah. And that often is, that spleen three often is very tender in people with spleen deficiency. They have that big knobby bunion area, the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. And just past that is spleen three, which often is very tender. Yeah.
Now, Sam, you were talking about using water points or metal points to treat this. Could you tell us a little more about that?
I believe it's from Master Nagano, and Kiko continued that approach. But basically, you're using that combination often, the metal and the water together, to cool the fire, which is just from a five-phase perspective. The water point obviously is controlling or cooling the fire. That's very easy to kind of think about. And then the metal point is basically tonifying the water, you know, giving to the water element to help extinguish that fire further.
Using the metal to promote the water in turn controls the fire. This is kind of interesting too, because the fire controls the metal. So if you've tonified the metal, now you're asking the heart or the fire, let's keep the language correct, you're asking the fire to send more energy down to the metal to keep it in check, which is another way of in a sense, drawing some energy out of the fire.
Yeah, I never thought about it from that third part of it, but that's interesting too, yeah. Yeah, it creates this nice circle. That's interesting. It's amazing how that, I think Sam is right. It's a good party trick because it is so reliable. It is so reliable. You know, you can have incredibly, and a lot of people, because of the structural aspect, maybe even more than just the kidney aspect, will have tenderness at that kidney too. And you can be so sensitive. And then with those two points, you can immediately eliminate that sensitivity. And then you mash your finger on it and they're amazed. Like, wow, that was like, you could barely touch that before. Now you can...
maybe at a party you use lung 10, not kidney two.
Yeah.
So you don't have to take off their pants or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking off the shoe sometimes is not a good party trick. Yeah. There could be some...
So with the lung in that case.
Yeah, lung TEN is another very, very common fire point that's tender. Yeah.
The lung TEN.
Yeah. For structural reasons, as well as the fact that our lungs are, our immune system, let's say our lung system, is always under some kind of semi-attack from external pathogenic factors. So,
right. Now, could you use this if somebody is coming down with like a wind heat kind of thing? Their throat is sore, they're a little sweaty, they're hot, maybe a little fever. Would this be a way to maybe pull some heat out of the lung with a external pathogen, or would this be something contraindicated for an external pathogen?
Definitely we would, and especially if they had the lung moo point also sensitive. So sometimes you may not have the fire point sensitive, but if the lung moo, lung one, is sensitive to palpation, then we would still use those, that combination, the metal water point, which would be lung eight, the metal point, lung five, the water point, to help drain that heat in the lung. But we would definitely add large intestine 11, let's say, to that, which is a more classic TCM concept, I think, as well. Although I'm sure for wind, a lot of people use large intestine 4, but large intestine 11 is also a very commonly used point.
In recent years, the Siam acupuncture style has generated significant interest and a loyal and growing following. In the Siam approach, a precise diagnosis leads to a four-needle treatment to address the five element and six qi imbalances in the body. The four needles target the controlling and generating cycles. It's common using this method for the needle sensation to be stronger than in many other styles. Thus, the choice of needle becomes important. The Unico brand of needles lends itself to both strong and gentle techniques. These superior needles are made of uncoated Japanese surgical stainless steel and feature the best guide tube on the market with its unique beveled edge. Additionally, Unico needles have a tensile property that helps with freehanding needles into Jingwell points and allows you to more easily feel the arrival of qi. Blue Poppy is the exclusive importer and distributor of Unico needles. Use the code QI2024 to save 10% off Unico needles at www.bluepoppy.com. You'll be glad you did.
Now, what do you like about that point?
What do we feel about? We love the large intestine 11, much more than large intestine 4.
Yeah. Tell me more about why you like it so much.
Well,
Earth point on the Earth channel.
Yeah, absolutely. We use it a lot in a way that may be different than TCM. So when there's an active problem in the body on a visceral level, we teach us in our course, we believe that that is going to be reflected in some way on the surface, on the way level that you can put your fingers on. And there's actually a science behind this, but large intestine 11 is a very classic area of the body that has that beautifully connected reflection of the lung problem, the lung heat. But what we do is something called a gummy hunt. So we don't just go to the anatomic point location, large intestine 11. We look for gummies or myogelosis, some kind of area of tension that's developed in the superficial fascia in the region between large intestine 10 to large intestine 11. So we actually, it's about a Tusun area where we look, and Kiko even say sometimes we should call it the largy warmer point, or the triple intestine point, because sometimes the point actually veers towards the triple warmer meridian in that fascia. And it's interesting because we, in our course, because of this attempt to always ground everything in science, we make a lot of bridges, and you can get people learning things empirically. So yes, they have heat as reflected, say, by tenderness at lung one or other symptoms that they're expressing to you, and then you look, do the gummy hunt, and you can relieve those symptoms at large intestine 10, 11. But why? The question is always, why is that reflected there? So we talk about this deep relationship, the somatovisceral, visceral-somatic relationships in the body that are actually wired on a neuroanatomic basis, but we, in modern medicine, have sort of forgotten. And yet it is there. The science is there that that, let's say, the lung is under attack from a Western standpoint, integrated into an Eastern standpoint with an external pathogenic factor. And so it will start to send signals to the spinal cord that something is wrong. And there are these interesting neurons in the spinal cord that are called wide dynamic range neurons that integrate information from the viscera with every other tissue in the body. So those same neurons that are receiving input from the lung saying something's not right here, something's not right here, are also integrated with nerves that come from fascia, that come from the skin, that come from ligaments and tendons, and all of that goes into this one cell. So the key piece that's often not recognized when people understand the neuroanatomy of how our nervous system works is that those sensory neurons don't just send signals in towards the spinal cord and then up to the brain, but those sensory neurons can actually, when they're activated enough, can send signals out in a retrograde fashion and release neuropeptides in the periphery. And actually then you get sensitized areas on the surface of the body that you can then lay your fingers on and say, oh, something's wrong with the lung. So there's actually a science behind it. And so we try to use those bridges to make people understand that, you know, yes, you need to learn that the large intestine 10, 11 area is very important to look, but it's not just coming out of nowhere. There is a science behind why the superficial layers react to these deeper visceral problems.
Wow. So we've got some good ideas of why that might be the case, just from looking at channel dynamics as we understand it traditionally through the tradition as it's been handed down to us. What I hear you saying is with these, what did you call it, wide dynamic range?
Yeah, wide dynamic range neurons.
Neurons, that there is a connection between our neurology, our hormonal system, our neurotransmitters, something else.
And the organs, yeah.
Our sensory system.
Our sensory system and the organs, and that reflects back out to the surface. That is mind-blowing. That Western science has ways of explaining this in ways that, it sounds to me, completely overlap with what the tradition says. And now there's mechanisms to see how it works. And these are actual physical substrates in our body.
And what I've always thought is that the channel system is somehow telling us something about the deep inner workings of the central nervous system, because we, you know, what I just said explains a lot about the fact that it can happen, that you can get tissue changes when there's a visceral problem, that you can palpate on the surface. But then the channel system is what helps guide us why large intestine 10, 11, you know, and that is the piece that I think is still missing in Western medicine. But I feel confident that eventually there'll be some higher level integration with understanding why certain regions, beyond just the basic segmental understanding, there's something that's more profound that the Chinese discovered after years and years of empirical observation, that there's this other level of connectedness in the body that follows that channel system.
Acupuncture is so much fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just endlessly fascinating.
There was this interesting guy named Sir Henry Head. So in the 19th century, in the pre-technological era of medicine in the West, people had to palpate, right? They didn't have MRIs, CAT scans, ultrasounds. They had to actually figure out what was going on with their patients, their ill patients, with palpation. And he came up with this whole series of head, H-E-A-D, head points, that he published in British Medical Journal. And he had certain points that he called the maximal points, that when someone had lung problems or someone had an ulcer in their stomach, there would be certain points that become hypersensitive that he called the maximal head points. And so there's this nice article that was published in 2011 by this German author that correlated the head points with the mu and shu points, and finds that there's about a 90% correlation with these points, that just careful observation of the body in a completely different tradition, in this case, a Western British medical tradition, found the same thing the Chinese found 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. So this, to me, this is something that Chip Chase used to say, that if qi is real, and if these things about acupuncture that we think are real actually are, there should be some kind of palpatory finding that relates to it. It could be very subtle. It could be less subtle. But there should be a palpatory reference, because it's something happening within the physical body. And this makes total sense to me, that completely different tradition, because we're looking at the same thing, the human body. And if you're paying attention in a certain way, things will show up. And it would be, what do they call that, interoperability or something? What is it? We're like, what is that phrase? We're like two different...
Inter-tester reliability.
Something like that. Like two different people from two different ways should find roughly the same thing, because you're looking at the same thing. Someone doing research would know the exact phrase.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Just to say this examination technique has a consistency in terms of different people applying it. Yeah.
That's right. Sam, I want to come back to you for just a moment. It sounds like you were doing a lot of work with Kiko, filming, helping get her materials out, teaching, helping her teach, particularly during COVID. And I mean, COVID, wow, there's a thing that still is a hot button, right? But let's jump into it anyway. Thank goodness, you know, and thank goodness COVID-23 is not the same as COVID-19.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know, how was Kiko thinking about COVID back when y'all were doing this?
You know, she really developed some interesting techniques, or especially for long COVID, different palpatory new ideas. And the fun thing with doing a course with Kiko, or helping to film her, or, you know, get the material set, is usually by the time the course is ready to happen, she's already on to something new. So then she has to end up teaching two things in that course, whatever she was supposed to teach, and then whatever she is now excited about next. So that's a really amazing joy of working with her, because her curiosity is just, it's amazing. It's infectious how she's always thinking and really so curious about what the ancient Chinese were up to. She's always investigating the point names and things like that to try to understand what the characters really meant, you know, because she has this huge dictionary, you know, Japanese, ancient Chinese dictionary that she's always looking at to try to unpack what the point characters really are indicating. You know, she'll get mad if you call it poetry. It's just poetry for the point names.
Well, I mean, there is a certain poetry, but there's also a real technology. And I mean, learning a little Chinese, like enough Chinese to know the point names in the language through the characters.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. So I'll just give you a very quick little example. We often hear about Ren 12, very helpful for stomach digestion, you know, internal digestive issues.
Right.
You know, and it is, if you put your hands on and palpate, you'll often find that the point just below it, which is Ren 11, Jen Li, construct the interior. The name is construct the interior, not the mu of the stomach. It's construct the interior. And I find what I learned I should use Ren 12 for in school, Ren 11 usually works better. In part, I was tipped off by the name. And in part, again, you put your hands on and palpate, it'll tell you things, you know. And this is where the point names can be really helpful. It's when you put your hands on, you palpate, and you're like, what the hell is this point doing showing up? This is not what I was told. This is not in the books. And then you look it up, and you're like, oh, wait a minute. There it is. Now I see it. So that can be helpful. It, you know, it is the art, not to mention a lot of fun.
Yeah, going back to the to COVID, you know, she really developed a lot of different techniques, especially with post-COVID, with long COVID. We would try to bring to, you know, whenever she teaches, she likes to have live demonstrations, cases of. So my dad will usually find his most difficult patients and bring them in. So yeah, we had some interesting long COVID patients with her who, you know, one thing we'd often see is that kind of almost spleen tenderness, you know, the kind of enlarged spleen, you know, a reflection of that kind of lymphatic stagnation maybe, or it could also maybe also digestive issues that are happening after COVID. And, you know, she would have different ways of addressing that. But one point that I thought was really fascinating is she would use spleen 8 often when someone has that spleen tenderness. And she was looking at the characters for that. I don't want to get it wrong. I think it's like DG or something. Earth Crux might be the name in the TCM book for that point. She was almost translating as like ashes to ashes. And it's kind of this regenerative point of healing the tissues in the body and healing them, releasing that kind of tenderness in that spleen area for long COVID patients. And I think, Dad, you kind of were writing about this too, how you find it helps patients breathe better.
Right. We saw a lot of patients, so it's interesting, that had that shortness of breath post-COVID. And it was all thought, oh, it's got to be something with their lungs or they had some kind of deep lung injury. But many of these patients, by the time I get a hold of them, because I'm not a pulmonary specialist, I'm a pain specialist. You know, by the time they've had CAT scans, they've had this and nothing showing up. And then we're getting them in to have Kiko treat them. And she presses on the actual spleen organ. So this is not the subtle spleen that we were talking about before based on five elements, but just mashing her finger under the ribs on the left side to palpate the spleen organ. And they would jump. We had one patient that started crying. It was so tender. And then I started thinking, why can't they breathe? If that spleen is about 3 or 4 times its normal size and their diaphragm is trying to descend as they breathe and it hits that spleen, it's like, I can't take a deep breath. And then she would treat the spleen apoid. The tenderness would go away immediately and they could breathe. So it was, and of course there is a relationship in TCM theory of the spleen to the lung, of course, in terms of nourishing the lung. So there is always layer upon layer of connection, but I thought on a basic anatomic standpoint, there was some kind of connection between that diaphragm not being able to fully descend.
Yep. Look, I'm from Missouri. It's the show me state. And so when I hear things that are in some ways very simple, like, oh, well, your spleen's a bit enlarged and it's tender. So as the diaphragm pushes on, it's like, no, don't push on that. Very, very simple, right? Oh, my ankle hurts. I can't put weight on it. Well, that's why you limp, right? Let's fix the ankle.
Right, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's some that kind of just basic truth. And that's actually, Kiko is interesting in that a lot of her thinking is, I always call it, you know, sort of magical or metaphor. She just likes to come up with a story and then she kind of follows that story. It's almost like a children's story about the body. But then she, of course, grounds it in her understanding of the point name meanings based on the Han Dynasty characters. But then she'll come up with this story. She'll, you know, let me see if this story works. And then she'll test it out in clinic. And then if the story works, then she'll start teaching.
Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense, right? Does this whole carry water?
Yeah.
Does this idea carry water? Well, let's find out. Oh, this doesn't carry water. Okay. Nice idea. Yeah. Bah, next. Right. Or, hey, that really worked. I'm looking up DG right now, spleen 8. I'm looking at the Deadman. They call it Earth Pivot, DG. But G, in this case, G also means mechanism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he calls it Earth Pivot. Okay. I'm not sure where that comes from, but mechanism, the character G, like a phagey, like an airplane is a flying mechanism, right? This is Earth mechanism. This point is Earth mechanism.
Ah,
yeah. Earth mechanics.
Interesting. Yeah. So like the deepest function of the earth. Yeah, like the earth.
Yeah, you could think of it as a deep function of earth, right? This is how the thing works. It's how it's put together.
What does it make you think of, Michael, the mechanism idea?
It makes me think that it's a great point for treating the earth and something I've overlooked. I mean, I'll often use spleen 9 because I want to deal with getting rid of some dampness. And then, you know, there's spleen 6 just because it's magical, basically. It just works for so many things, right? It's like the Lowe's hardware store. It's got everything you need, right? But earth mechanism, okay, now I want to think about pairing earth mechanism perhaps with Gen Li, construct the interior, Ren 11. That might be potent, yeah? So, I mean, this is why acupuncture is so much fun, right? We're just sitting here, we're hanging out, we're riffing on how this stuff works. It's like, I wonder if these things go together. I don't know. Well, let's go check it out and we'll report back, you know?
Sounds good.
That's great.
Yeah, this idea that Kiko has too, she always will talk about metaphorically that the points are like these caves. And if you can mine the point somehow, get into that cave, that deep part of that point, you'll discover the gold. You know, you'll discover the gold. That idea that she had, though, I took it literally and I said, you know, a lot of points really are holes. They're like these deep caves. And so that was this kind of going back to my origin story. But I was always trying to find a way to balance the very yang aspect of Mark Seam's approach with trigger points, with dry needling, and Kiko's sort of poo-pooing that. That's like, if you have to do a trigger point, it means you haven't done a good treatment, you know? You've got to find that point, spleen 8, that just the whole body, everything gets better. And if you look at the actual kind of literature of fascia and stuff, a lot of when someone is ill, and this relates back to these somatovisceral somatic relationships, but the fascia starts to get disorganized. Like when you can palpate things that you're feeling something's not right here, there's a tension. There's actual science now showing that the kind of smooth relationships between the connective tissue have been destroyed. And that's partly what's leading to that sense that you have with your fingers that something is not right. And so I started playing around with this idea that instead of doing trigger points, if you could needle the fascial holes, like in between the muscles, you'll find in between the fascial connections where you have all these interconnecting muscle tissues that are leading to this structurally integral body that can move in space. And I started thinking about, well, there's a huge literature on this in a way, in this whole world of tensegrity, like these buildings that are built that are called tensile membranes, where you have these very stiff elements like steel, or in the case of humans, bones, interconnected with these more flexible membranes like the connective tissue. And there's a whole science what happens when those tensile membranes get distorted. And what happens is the membrane dimples. It, like the to absorb the shock or the forces that are disrupting it, the membrane will dimple to absorb that shock. And I started saying, well, I bet that happens in the human body. And so I started playing around with needling these deep fascial holes that you can find in different regions of the body, and not really trying to address the muscle layer, but more the fascial layers that are in between the muscles. And finding that you could get everything you could achieve with a needling of the muscle, but much more. You'd get these remote effects. If you learn how to needle it correctly, you could actually get like 3 or 4 muscles twitching all at once. And so that it became very economical in terms of time too, instead of, and I felt it connected more with this Kiko idea that you're not kind of brutally going to that surface energetic, but you're finding some intermediary that is more deeply connected to that deeper visceral level, but is still on that fascial way level, and finding a way to needle it. And so this is this whole different approach that we use to do the so-called dry needling, which I think is in certain circles is become taboo in terms of, you know, in the acupuncture world, the term dry needling evokes so much anger because of this usurp, you know, the way that physical therapists have sort of started doing this. And we could get into, I don't know if we really want to talk about that part of it, but bottom line is there is something about learning how to needle the fascia the right way that could be much more in sync with an overall acupuncture point of view and really be more harmonious with your overall treatment that is on that more Zong Fu level.
Well, and more gentle.
And more gentle, yeah.
And in some ways, what I'm hearing you say, more effective, you get more muscle twitching, simultaneous release of different muscles, because you're actually going to the underlying substrate
right.
That's holding the problem in place, rather than going in like, okay, I got some blasting caps, like kaboom.
Yeah, let's just kneel one ashi point after another and torture the patient, right?
Right. Well, you know, which you can do to some degree, but look, I got plenty of people that come to me and they go, you don't do that dry needling, do you? And I go, no. They go, good, because I didn't like that, right? Now I'm here to see you. And I mean, I get it why acupuncturists put the word dry needling on their website, because they're trying to attract some attention. They're trying to attract some customers. It's very popular these days. But man, if we can do, I'm using air quotes, dry needling in a way more commensurate with how we can learn to understand the body, something that our tradition and modern science, as you're talking about it, hold to be true and interconnected, then we can do this, again, trigger point, air quotes, work in a more effective and gentle way. That is awesome. We don't have time to go into more of that today, but maybe you'll come back another day and we can really dig into that. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, I so appreciate your time today, and it's been such a delight to hear Joe, your amazing winding path from wrenching your back to the work that you're doing, combining East and West in your work. And Sam, here you are. You're lucky.
Yeah.
Many of us grew up, we didn't even hear of acupuncture. And if we did, it was like, well, that sounds really weird. I mean, I remember the first time I ever saw acupuncture being done, I could not have been more disinterested because I just had no way to think about anything that was going on. I remember it was part of a seminar when I was in school. And I was just like, yeah, I don't even know how to think about it. I was totally disinterested. And here you are. You know, second generation. And Wang Jui said this. Wang Jui, the famous Beijing acupuncturist, said that what's really going to save acupuncture is not what happens in China. It's how it continues to develop in the West. So, you know, things come and go.
This is the beauty. I think, yeah, we have a lot of creativity in this country, and I think acupuncture is flourishing. So it's a wonderful thing.
That's great. Gentlemen, again, thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to another moment when we can sit down together.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been wonderful.
It's a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for all the wonderful work you do.
Yes, absolutely.
I loved talking with Joe and Sam, and it's heartening that there are now second-generation acupuncturists, and more than that, that acupuncture is alive and well here in Western soil. That the medicine is not just an imported exotic, but it has roots here, and that practitioners here are contributing and adding to the long tradition. I appreciated Joe's ability to blend his Kiko and Western medicine thinking and practice. I think it's a sign of mastery when you can take something complex and make it sound simple. I've watched Kiko's work before, and it was like watching a cyclone. Listening to Joe, I was able to grasp some of what I had previously failed to see. Sam, he was just finishing school when we recorded this conversation, but I just heard from him the other day with the news that he's graduated. So gongxi gongxi, congratulations on that, Sam. And we are looking forward to hearing more about your work as you develop it. Thanks as always for listening.
If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.